This week, the Nelson Daily News delivered another in its regular stream of editorials from the Fraser Institute. This time it was Alexander Moen's, and an article entitled Actions That Do Good Versus Strategies That Do Good. Moen's places himself squarely on the bandwagon by echoing the view that Paul Martin's cheeky stand on softwood lumber is no more than posturing and bluster. U.S. Ambassador David Wilkins speaks of Canada's emotional tirades on softwood lumber and reminds himself and his boss that Canada's elections are not far off. Rex Murphy, himself the Canadian champion of bluster and fine rhetorical chastisement, agreed that 4 to 6 months was very soon for an election and implied that Martin's tough talk was no more than a lecture delivered by an elected comedian. Moen's, whose opinions as senior fellow in American policy at the Fraser Institute ought to be more interesting, wags his finger and warns us that, quote, threats, bluffs, and grandstanding will not work, unquote, to manipulate the American president as if he had clearly identified what was at stake. But what if the debate about softwood lumber is more serious than deciding which pose will be the most electable? What if Canada really can't trust its trading relationship with the United States, as Moen's puts it? A large minority of Canadians would be glad to see Martin abrogate NAFTA. But the National Post recently pointed out in an editorial on this same subject that Canada's trade with the U.S. has tripled since the signing of the original free trade agreement. That's pretty good, isn't it? Funny how the same facts that free market cheerleaders use to celebrate their favorite game are so easily recycled by critics to prove the opposite position. Canada's trade with the United States has been dangerously out of balance for a long time. Mr. Moen's provides the current details, beginning with those that are most familiar. Quote, just over 80% of all our exports in products go to the USA, but only 23.5% of their total exports go to Canada. Nearly 60% of all our imports come from the USA, but only 17% of American imports come from Canada. About half of all that we make, he goes on, we sell to the Americans, but that only amounts to 3% of what they consume. About 35% of all that we consume comes from them, but that only amounts to 2% of everything they produce. The sum total of all those exports and imports with the USA forms 52% of our gross domestic product, but the sum of all we sell and buy from them adds up to only 5% of their GDP. Do we need more? What's the point? He's coming to that, but just in case you aren't convinced, he does go on for a bit more. Quote, of all the investment dollars we get from abroad into Canada, that's foreign direct investment, or FDI for those of you who follow such things, to build and produce things, 65% comes from the USA. Of all the investment dollars the USA gets to build and produce things, just 8% comes from Canada. End quote. The inevitable conclusion of this statistical litany should be obvious to all, and Mr. Moen's puts it well. Quote, with that kind of asymmetry, Canada cannot risk a strategy that would invite American escalation or retaliation. End quote. Don't upset the Americans. The size and imbalance of our trading relationship with the United States produces a stranglehold on Canada's ability to pursue its own real interests whenever they are independent of those of the U.S. This is not a new story. Trudeau recognized it and proposed to increase trade with Europe to correct the imbalance. Even Canadian investors have recognized it. The U.S. share of Canadian investment abroad has fallen from around 63% in 1980 to just under 44% in 2004. Even so, as the National Post editorial pointed out, NAFTA has tripled the imbalance in our trading relationship. The next question will come as a surprise to no one. Shall we embrace this stranglehold and do only what makes the American market happy? Or shall we seize every opportunity to take steps that will change it? Diverging answers to that question give rise to a divide that is arguably one of the most important in Canadian politics. It crosses the boundary between liberal and conservative, between French and Anglo, even between capitalists and socialists. Mowens dedicates half a sentence to concede that, quote, diversifying trade is rational policy, unquote. But then he starts wagging his finger again, quote, the effectiveness of political missions to make business deals is another matter, end quote. Mowens is crafty enough to leave his position on that much more important other matter to guesswork, but Conservative MP Rona Ambrose is not so cunning. On CTV's Sunday political show Question Period, she said, quote, Paul Martin doesn't have the power to tell private companies who they can and cannot sell energy to, end quote. Ambrose gets full marks for having read the textbook, but in fact, socialism still works in China, and thanks to Dr. Norman Bethune, China is well aware of Canada's venerable socialist tradition. It's true that China is often cited as a trade liberalization success story, but the truth is that China's big increase in economic growth began in the 80s, a decade before liberalization began. China's government held back liberalizing its trade in most goods until it could compete in those areas in world markets. As late as 1992, its average tariff was still over 40%. Some food tariffs today are still reported to be as high as 65%. China's transition to a mixed economy, such as Canada used to have, was gradually and carefully orchestrated by the government. There were pilot projects, special economic zones to experiment with foreign capital and technology, and gradual liberalization of prices, all deliberately designed so as to be able to correct mistakes and expand upon successes. As late as 1996, state-owned and collective enterprises accounted for 75% of urban employment in China. Even today, 25 years into China's economic transition, they still account for more than one-third of urban jobs. As Mark Weisbrot, Dean Baker, and David Rosnick point out in their scorecard on development, this stands in sharp contrast to the shock therapy, massive and rapid privatization, and rapid decontrol of prices that led to an economic collapse and loss of nearly half of Russia's GDP in 5 years. Not to mention the economic catastrophe that devastated Argentina. That China has been able to manage its transition without any such setbacks, and by contrast with record-breaking economic growth over a 25-year period, is a compelling example of how important economic policy decisions can be. In the real world, politically led trade missions to China are paying off in real dollars. In 2003, the Canadian Embassy in Beijing reported over 400 Canadian companies now have a permanent presence in China. That was more than double the number when Jean Chrétien took the first Team Canada trade mission to China in November 1994. In fact, Canada's trade relations with China have expanded steadily since 1961, when Canada made its first wheat sale to China. This year, deals have been concluded with three Chinese oil companies, which are majority owned by the government of China, but trade as public companies. In April, PetroChina signed a preliminary deal to take 200,000 barrels a day from a pipeline being planned between the oil sands in Alberta and Prince Rupert on the BC West Coast. In May, Chinese National Overseas Oil Company paid $150 million for a 1/6 stake in MEG Energy, a small Canadian company with proprietary oil sands technology. Also in May, Sino-Canada Petroleum Corporation paid another $150 million for a stake in the Northern Lights oil sands project. At the end of the Banff Global Business Forum, Alberta Premier Ralph Klein was delighted. I met with them in Beijing, he said, apparently on his own trade mission in June 2004, and true to their word, they came over to examine the potential of investing in the tar sands. We encourage their investment, said Klein. On October 13th, Natural Resources Minister John McCollum met with the presidents of two of China's biggest state-owned oil companies, PetroChina and Sinuk Limited. McCollum says the Chinese could be importing as much as 400,000 barrels of oil a day by 2012. Chinese and Canadian investors in Beijing called it an ambitious but realistic target. McCollum called it a very good beginning, but the New York Times saw the negotiations as a series of subtle threats, and Neil Reynolds at the Globe and Mail reckons that 400,000 barrels really belongs to the U.S. Go figure. Canada's trade with China goes well beyond oil and gas, including other resources, agriculture, software, biotechnology, and tourism. But even with all this activity, it will be a long time before Canada does even half its trading with countries other than the U.S. That means diversification of the Canadian economy is not just a rational policy, as Moens would have it. It is both an urgent and a long-term necessity. The trade imbalance Moens delineates so precisely is ongoing and more corrosive to Canada's independence and national security than nuclear-armed missiles or terrorism. NAFTA has driven this so-called asymmetry from extreme to grotesque. That's it for this Monday. If you would like to suggest a story or comment about anything you hear on World Report, email Earthling, that's EARTHLING, at netidea.com. Put World Report in the subject line to make sure I don't mistake your message for spam. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.